Is the fence in Spain the same? I'll start with the end. The same as the fence in Gaza. I find that there is a nice or an intriguing mistake in the formulation of the question, or I don't know if it's a Freudian slip, or because the fences you're referring to for the first is not in Spain but in Morocco. And the second, yes, is in Gaza to a large extent, but it's more than that. It's in the West Bank. I mean, it's the fence under construction, whose model, I agree, is already there in Gaza. Yes, in a recent working paper that I gave last year in Canada at McMaster University in Hamilton, and you can find that on the web, called Strangers as Enemies. I started with a comparison and an association of these two fences. That was, of course, an exaggeration meant to make a certain problem perceptible, more visible. They indeed are not the same. I suggested that they could be seen as elements together with other realities and that we could invoke of a virtual border under construction, so to speak. On the southern edge of the Euro-Mediterranean space, which is both a geopolitical space and a cultural space. So what I suggested was that they could be articulated, not identified, but articulated in order to illustrate at the same time the violence, I would say, of this virtual conflict and its complexity. What they seem to have in common is the fact that precisely they are located on the southern side of the Mediterranean Sea, but they work to a large extent as projections in a quasi strategic sense of the northern power and structure within the South itself. Now, this, of course, involves a certain representation of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in terms of colonial reality after the official end of colonization, which is objectionable, I mean, which is disputable, and which certainly, in my opinion, only covers part, I mean, explains part of the situation there. There would be another point of view which could describe the situation in Palestine, Israel, rather in terms of civil war, and that would lead to very different analyses. Now, return to the previous and give my prepared answers. Previous questions. I like your putting together the different semantic dimensions of the term border. They seem to belong to completely different to completely different ranges or disciplines, epistemological considerations on concept construction, and therefore rationality on one side, geopolitics, and on the other side, anthropology again, the human and the infrahuman. I think that there is more than a metaphor here, but indeed a real affinity. What seems to me to be conceptual, precisely in the examples that you, or the examples that you give, the situation that you allude to, is precisely the fact that that strikes me, the way you indicate borders or describe borders is not contrary to what could be imagined or anticipated by drawing a line of separation between homogeneous, precisely, or similar spaces. So the border you want us to reflect on, happen, is not a pure border. It's an impure border. It's not the kind of border you had said in the beginning. Thank you for crossing the border between the continent and Britain, the Channel. Channel is a thick line. It's not much more than that today. So, and which separates homogeneous spaces, nation territories. So on one side you have the territory, the yellow territory or the blue territory, and on the other side you have the red territory or the green territory. That's how they are on the maps. They're on the maps. But, and these do not pose, in fact, very difficult conceptual problems. Undoubtedly, they are a part, that's a very interesting aspect, they are part of a certain form of rationality, precisely, a certain form of picturing the world, rationalizing the world. It's, historians and geographers have plenty to say about that. The invention of the map, the mapping of the world, the progressive. It was not initially exactly the same, but the progressive convergence between the intellectual and scientific activity, which draws map on the surface of the earth and therefore represents the complexity of its. Its continents and populations, and the progressive construction of the system of nation states, which was achieved only with the decolonization. But this is relatively simple compared to the kind of problems that you are alluding to, where the category of heterogeneity used by Sandro Mezzadra a moment ago becomes absolutely central. The comparisons, the borders that you are alluding are limits impossible to perfectly locate, constantly shifting, if you like. Between a certain subject, this subject can be a culture, this subject can be a political, a national or supranational entity, and its various others. And the problem comes from the fact that the others, as you perfectly say, are located simultaneously. This is a result of history. This is perhaps a consequence of the very way in which otherness has been defined. They are located outside, and they're located inside, and therefore, in fact, they call for a certain representation of the border, and simultaneously they render it or make it. Or make it dubious and in fact impossible. Now the extreme edge or side of this abstract pattern has very concrete and violent consequences, and this is what you allude to when you speak of the border between the human and the infra-human. The border between the human and the infra-human is an ideological and phantasmatic limit or border that becomes drawn or instituted within the human itself, within the human itself, by means of representation of some human groups, precisely as non-human or infra-human or quasi-human or incompletely human, and so on. I tend to believe that this is the racist invariant as such. Racism has been elaborated as a discourse and as a system of institutions over the last 300 or 400 years in relationship to various social kinds of institutions in different ways, using different types of discourse, quasi-biological, religious or pseudo-religious, cultural, and so on. But basically, it always had to do with that, precisely. Imposing a limit within, a violent limit within the human itself, and rejecting, so to speak, part of the human into the realm, the fantastic realm of the non-human. Now this might very well be, and this is a disturbing element, this might very well be something like the dark side of the modern humanist discourse. And the discourse of democracy and emancipation. I'm not reducing democracy and humanism to that, but I, in the critical tradition that we were invoking a moment ago, I'm once again calling for the recognition of this dark side, which, in a sense, I tend to explain that in my classes on political theory. Derives from the fact that modernity, having proclaimed and declared that the rights of each and every human being is equal, I mean, is the same, and in the end has to be acknowledged and instituted politically and socially. The only possibility to deny certain rights or to build stable, enduring power relations on the denial of certain rights to a given category of individuals is precisely to fantastically expel them from or deny them full humanity. Now, this is also the reason why it's impossible in the last instance. Why it's a site of permanent resistance and struggle. And finally, Islam. Now, this is the continuation of the same question. I'm struck by the fact that, and I agree with the use of this term, what has become figured as an ideological border between Europe, and Islam. Strangely, these are not symmetric terms. These are not symmetric terms. How come that something like a conflict or an incompatibility or a political contradiction is again and again presented to us in terms of an opposition between Europe and Islam? This would make sense in the logical from a logical point of view only if Europe were identified with Christianity, for example, a religion or a religious identity, which is a lasting idea, a very important one in European history. It would be important to identify the moments and the conditions in which it was invented and created, which not by chance, of course, is returning today. And if on the other side Islam was a political entity, so neither is true. In fact, neither is true. So my provisional conclusion from that is precisely that we have to do with an ideological construction. This ideological construction is instrumental, in fact, in transforming certain cultural, social conflicts and changes and processes into political antagonisms after the well-known model of the friend versus foe or friend versus enemy pattern. Does that work? Yes. This is last thing I want to say. With this disturbing, qualification or proviso that it in fact immediately includes what it tries to exclude. I mean, or admits what it tries to deny, namely the fact that the enemy in quote or the other, the extreme other, the incompatible other, etc., is not an external element, but is part of us, as Islam is part of monotheism, as populations of with of Muslim descent or with Islamic cultural references for centuries now, and perhaps more than that, have been an intrinsic part of the history of Europe and the Euro-Mediterranean space. So as a consequence, what is produced, and it's a perilous moment, but also possibly one that could lead to a better understanding of the world in which we live, is not a radical polarization or simplification of the complex political world in which we live, but it's rather, it's just the opposite. I mean, it's a destruction of the illusory completeness and the purely self-referential character of European politics. And that's my.
Oh. There were so many things that came to my mind while listening at Etienne's quick-fire statements. Nevertheless, I will try once again to keep my answer pretty short. So first point, in your question, you were talking about what citizenship might mean in a genuinely democratic Europe. To be honest, I have no idea about what citizenship might mean in a genuinely democratic Europe. To be more precise, this was not and is not the kind of approach that I have to the issue of citizenship. I have no normative approach to the study of citizenship. I try to avoid a normative approach to citizenship. What I have tried to do in my work on the subject was opening up the concept of citizenship and working within its manifold crises. I tried, in a way, to discover both from an historical point of view and from a theoretical political point of view the possibility of a movement of citizenship that challenges its borders. So what I'm always stressing is the possibility of thinking of citizenship as a contested concept and field. And I think that this concept of citizenship can be particularly useful when looking at our present in Europe, but not only in Europe. I mean, if you look at what is going on in different parts of the world, if you look at social movements and social struggles, forms of resistance that are developing in different continents, you can notice that the language of citizenship is very much widespread within social movements, within these struggles. But you can be sure that the most interesting attempts to frame these social struggles in terms of citizenship are the ones that aim at contesting the borders of existing citizenship and opening it up. I don't believe that much of the work that has been done in recent years around the concept of participative democracy, for instance, has led to conclusions in terms of models of citizenship that are more important than what have to say about citizenship such movements as the Sem Terra movement in Brazil or the many peasants movements in India that have referred to the concept of citizenship. So I was talking about movements challenging the borders of citizenship, and I was already introducing the second point I'd like to make. Etienne was stressing the fact that the concept of border has many different dimensions that have been put together in the question asked by Chetan. And I think that one of the things that make the issue of border particularly thought-provoking is precisely its multi-level constitution. And I would say that our present condition is characterized by the fact that multiple crises crisscross the concept of border in each of its many dimensions. And so we have to try to distinguish these dimensions, but also to consider them together in order to get an idea of what borders are becoming nowadays. The concept of border also if we look at this concept just from kind of, let's say, geopolitical, to use a bad word, point of view, can be a particularly effective perspective on the transformations of economic, legal, political, cultural spaces I was referring to before. I think that what should be done is to try to connect the excellent work that has been done in the last years around the issue of borders precisely with the transformations of the capitalist mode of production Etienne was referring to in his previous comment. Etienne was quoting a well-known statement by Marx in the Communist Manifesto: a capital is approaching is its limit point. But I think that we should ask, after hearing such a statement, a further question, that is, can capital exist without a limit? Is it possible to conceive, especially of the dynamism of capital, without taking into account the existence of limits? This is a question I would like to ask, putting together once again different theoretical influences, ranging from Ferdinand Braudel to some theorists of ecological socialism. So I think that the situation of capitalism nowadays, if we look at its global scope, is precisely characterized that capital as to continuously produce new limits, to continuously open up new territories that it has, let's say, to colonize. And the border is particularly important as kind of technology of power and of governmentality in order to make this continuous production of new limits to be overcome possible. This is, I think, a quite effective point of view from which we can take over all the work that has been done in the last years by critical scholars in the field of border studies. Another important point is to try to link the question of border with the very question of heterogeneity I was talking about before. Borders are nowadays key devices in the articulation of different spaces, different modalities, let's say, of capture of living labor by capital. They are key devices in articulating different forms of production that coexist in the same spaces in current capital. From this point of view, I would like to say a couple of words about the question on the relation between the fence around Ceuta and Melilla, north of Morocco, and the fence in Gaza and the West Bank. I think they are rather different technologies of power. The formats, the fences around Ceuta and Melilla, are part of a system, what I would like to call the new migration and border regime in the making in Europe, that point at producing a kind of selective inclusion of migrants within the space of European citizenship. And in so doing, it continuously produces and reproduces new hierarchies within this space. New elements of heterogeneity that are crucial in order to understand the transformations of European citizenship. The fence in Gaza is a kind of defensive technology of power that points at assigning different populations to different territories. From this point of view, I would like to add that these two technologies of power, represented by very concrete borders, fences, walls, are just two examples of, once again, the heterogeneity of the technologies of power that characterize the world we are living in. We could look, for instance, at the zoning technologies that have been key engines of development in China in the last two decades. These zoning technologies are once again producing borders. If you look at the condition of migrants, of internal migrants in China, you can see that this condition is deeply shaped and influenced by the action of these very concrete zoning technologies that produce and reproduce borders. There is excellent ethnographic work being done on this subject. And this ethnographic work has a lot to say also about some of the key concepts of political theory. Let's only think of three very important concepts in the modern definition of the state. That is citizenship, sovereignty, and territory. If you look from this point of view at China, you are compelled to recognize that you are confronted there with a very different constellation from the one that has been characteristic of the history of the modern state in Europe. When people talk against the idea of globalization, saying it was kind of blah blah of the 1990s, they used to refer to the fact that the new emerging powers are national powers. I don't think this is the case. If you look at China, for instance, you can see very easily that the nation there is something really very different from what has been imagined, constructed, lived in the age that was dominated by the national state. You have a very heterogeneous, once again, territory in China. I mean, from a very legal point of view, not as an image, as a metaphor, you have forms of graduated citizenship and forms of graduated sovereignty, to introduce two concepts that have been proposed by Iowa Ong in her last book that has excellent chapters on China. The border is a critical point of view that allows us to deepen our knowledge of these transformations that are reshaping also some of the classical concepts that we still use when we talk about politics. Of course, the borders are also very concrete institutions. We are talking about a kind of deterritorialization of borders, but borders are still linked to specific places. Many people die every day in the attempt to cross borders. And we cannot never forget this kind of tragedy. Please.
I'll be back in a second.
Of course. So we should resist the temptation of we should resist the temptation of reducing borders to an image, to a metaphor. Nonetheless, I think that the border, as I was saying, can also be a very effective critical point of view from which we are allowed to look at some of the crucial transformations that are shaping the present. In order to limit myself to some political transformations of the border, I will make just three very short points on the so-called European external frontiers. If you look at the European external borders, you can see at least three sets of very important processes that are going on and that in a way signal deep transformations of the very institute of the border. On the one hand, you can see quite easily that the nation state has no more a monopoly over the control of borders. If you look at the Mediterranean Sea, if you look at the eastern border of the European Union, you are confronted with emerging patterns of shared control of the border. You can find, of course, nation states that still play an important role in controlling borders, but you can also find sovranational agencies, as, for instance, Frontex, the new European Agency on Frontiers. You can find even NGOs. You find the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. You find a very obscure subject as the International Organization for Migration. And these different players are sharing what has been traditionally one of the main competencies that make up sovereignty. Second important point, if you look at the border from the point of view of the classical legal theory, you are confronted with an image of the border as a kind of edge of the territorial validity of the state legal system. This is more or less the definition of the border given by Hans Kelsen. But look now at what is going on in the Mediterranean Sea or at the eastern border of the European Union. They are not the edges of a European legal system, which is already something very complicated and nonetheless exists. they are not the edges of the territorial validity of this legal system. They are rather kind of junctures that articulate and project this legal system toward the outside, involving different close and far countries in the management of the border itself, exercising pressures on the legal systems of these countries, and so on. And if you take seriously this fact, you are also, in a way, compelled, and this is for me a very important point, to abandon a rigid dichotomy of inclusion and exclusion, of what is inside, what is outside. You are at least compelled to problematize a concept that is still very much used, especially with reference to migrants, that is the concept of integration. Third point I would like to make about the European external border is the fact that these borders are, as I was saying before, technologies of power that constantly produce and reproduce the inscription within the space of European citizenship of subjects that are going to be subordinated, that are going to be hierarchized within this space. And so from this point of view, once again, the border is a key device in producing heterogeneity. Last thing I would like to say on the subject of borders has once again to do with the question I was shortly mentioning before of inclusion and exclusion, inside and outside. There are many scholars, excellent scholars, who work on the subject of borders from the point of view of a critic of exclusion. Borders are criticized and analyzed as technologies that produce exclusion, that produce, in a way, bare life, in the sense of Giorgio Agamben. I'm not sure this is the most productive perspective on borders. I rather think that borders are confronting us with key transformations of the devices of what we should call inclusion. And so to criticize borders, to imagine processes of democratization of borders, to use words suggested several years ago by Etienne, means not that much to look at exclusion, but rather to look at changing status of the technologies of inclusion.